Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Across the U.S., students and faculty are continuing to resist repressive measures by university administrations intended to stifle or even criminalize speech in support of Palestinian rights as this genocide continues. As we've been reporting, along with elite U.S. institutions calling the riot cops on their own students who have been holding sit-in protests, or attempting to prevent students from holding protests altogether, some universities have tried to categorize the political ideology of Zionism as a protected identity class in order to criminalize anti-Zionist speech as racist hate speech. Joining us to talk about all of this is Maura Finkelstein. Maura is a scholar and was a professor of anthropology for 9 years at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Even though she was tenured, she was fired earlier this year over her social media posts in support of Palestinian rights and against Zionism, a move that has been seen as a warning to other anti-genocide professors in this expanding McCarthyist atmosphere in U.S. higher education. Maura, it's so good to have you with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you. It's such an honor to be here. I've really appreciated the work that you all have done so much. It's been really meaningful.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Well, The Intercept first published a lengthy article in late September detailing what happened to you, and they reported that your firing over social media posts, quote, followed months-long efforts aimed at pressuring the college to remove you, with online crusaders, primarily led by anonymous Muhlenberg alumni. Maura, give us an overview of what happened in May, but also what led up to your firing and the enormous amount of vitriol and harassment directed at you for your anti-Zionist political beliefs. You were, as is the norm, called an anti-Semite. You were accused of Jew hatred, despite the fact that you're yourself Jewish, but that never seems to really matter when it comes to these attacks and the people behind them. What happened?
Yeah, thanks so much for that. So it is, you know, I'll preface the what happened over the past year by saying that as long as I've been a teacher, I've been teaching about Palestine. It's always been either central or integrated into the work that I do. I'm a generalist anthropologist, so I'm always looking for examples of scholarship to illuminate the lessons I'm teaching in my classroom. So for, you know, years at Muhlenberg, I had been teaching a class on Palestine. It was specifically the anthropology of Palestine, had been approved by the college. I was incorporating units on Palestine in all of my classes, teaching Palestinian scholars and scholars of Palestine. And I even was supported by my institution financially and, you know, emotionally and intellectually to go to Palestine one summer. I needed my institution to pay for the plane ticket to go along with the fellowship I received, and they were happy to do it because I had won a fellowship. So all of this is to say that our institutions support us when they want to, and you know that's conditional. So I was doing what I always do in September and early October of last year. I had two classes. I was teaching about Palestine in both of those classes and had actually already completed my units on Palestine. And so the only responsible thing I could do as a teacher and a scholar after October 7th is help my students understand and contextualize what was being classified as an event, as something within the longer history of settler colonial occupation and genocide we had already learned about. And so I did that. And you know, that sort of started a series of events that involved one student who was taking both my classes filing a complaint and later filing an OCR complaint. And it also involved, you know, word getting out through my social media and through other spaces that alumni had access to that I was an anti-Zionist, that I was teaching about Palestine. And a petition was drawn up that was calling me a Hamas supporter, which, you know, was based on nothing, you know, whatever that means, it's another conversation, but was based on, you know, me being an anti-Zionist and standing in support with Palestinian liberation. And there was a lot of talk on the internet about how my very existence made Jewish students feel unsafe. So, you know, I had this one student who filed a complaint and later withdrew it. There were 16 students at Hillel International who, unfortunately, my department shares a building with Hillel. So we were actually in the same space. They filed a complaint that because of my social media, I made them feel unsafe. And we can talk about the language and weaponization of unsafety in addition to anti-Semitism. And all of this, you know, there was also attention drawn to my publications. I wrote an essay called Never Again Means Never Again for Anyone, in which I was accused of being a Holocaust denier because I felt as though, you know, we should be standing against all genocide. And so this just involved a lot of surveillance of my teaching, my scholarship, my publications by my institution, in which it felt as though the administration was looking for a space to push into. And all of this sort of went quiet over the winter break. And then on January 17th, I was notified by the provost of the first day of the semester that there was an OCR complaint against me, against Muhlenberg College, naming me. And a few days later, I was placed on administrative leave because of one, what I learned was one of the eight complaints, which was from a student I have never met, still to this day, I've never met her. I knew this student existed because the student had been surveilling my social media for months at that point, but the student filed a complaint in which they claimed that the social media post, which was a repost of something Rami Kanazi, the Palestinian poet, wrote that was about not normalizing Zionism, that because the student identified as a Zionist and because the student believed that Zionism and Judaism were the same, that I was violating the equal opportunity non-discrimination policy that essentially would be denying the student access to an education, because even the student did not know me and had never taken my class, the student assumed from the social media post that they would not be safe in my class. It went through a 3.5 months investigation. It went through, you know, various, you know, faculty, staff, and administrative panels. And I was told that I was terminated for cause, which is like immediately no access to severance. Your behavior is so egregious that, you know, pending an appeal, you're done.
And just to make clear, the OCR is the Office for Civil Rights at the Department of Education. So that's a federal complaint. I mean, we've covered that, you know, for, yeah. I mean, it seems like decades now. It has been decades where Israel lobby groups habitually file complaints to the Office for Civil Rights at the DOE, alleging that Jewish some Jewish students' rights are being violated. And because of, you know, sometimes the mere presence of Palestine rights activity on campuses. And, you know, as we know, most of these complaints, you know, sit around for a while, then they get tossed out. There's no recrimination. There's no, you know, like post-examination of these kinds of complaints, but they just get kind of refiled and refiled and refiled as a way to, instill a sort of self-censorship sort of, you know, on campuses by both students and faculty if they speak out on Palestine. But anyway,
And I think what's important about what you're drawing attention to is with these OCR complaints. So there were eight specific complaints against me, five of which were anonymous complaints based on my social media. They could have been filed by anyone. They could have all been filed by the same person. You don't actually have to be credibly attached to an institution or in relation to the person or group that you're filing a complaint against in order to do so. So three of them were recognizable. Two of them, by the time the OCR report was filed, had already been investigated by the college and was found to be baseless. And then the last one, the equal opportunity complaint, that was the one. And I think this is, we're seeing this more and more at NYU, at UCLA, across the country, that this equation of Judaism and Zionism is finding its sort of like final collision in these equal opportunity complaints.
Yeah. I mean, and this is after, you know, also decades of trying to codify the definition of anti-Semitism to mean criticism of the Israeli state, Israeli policies, and Zionism as a political ideology. And as you mentioned, like NYU, Barnard, and now apparently, you know, Muhlenberg have adopted this, this codification, this kind of like this collision, as you said, with you know, trying to really blend make, you know, indistinguishable Judaism as a religion, as a culture, as tradition, with Zionism, which is a very new political ideology predicated on ethno supremacy and genocide. You know, can you talk? And it seems like what happened to you ultimately in May when they fired you, and again, you're a tenured professor. This is very rare that this mm-hmm. happens. Was that they, you know, this is maybe the first instance that we know of in the last 13 months where an anti-Zionist professor has been fired, a tenured professor has been fired over this really a depraved, you know, codification of, you know, this, you know, attempt at marrying Judaism and Zionism as a protected identity.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's so many different factors at play here. Since October 7th, 2023, as far as like the AAUP is aware, I'm the first faculty member with tenure who's fired. Of course, there were cases in the past. Steve Salaita is one of the most right. well-known one. But, you know, there are countless adjuncts, visiting assistant professors, lecturers, other contingent faculty who have lost their contracts, who've lost their jobs without the same kind of foundation that would cause outrage. And, you know, also there is this the fear of for folks who are being sanctioned now that if they go public with the story, they'll never work in higher ed again. And I think that that's a real threat. We've seen that happen before. And, you know, with my case, I think it sort of crystallizes at least two of the big crises in higher ed right now. One is the fact that particularly at a private college like my own, but any college or university across the country, the constant erosion of federal funding, of federal support has created these institutions so that they're completely or almost completely dependent on tuition and donor support. And so if you've created this, you know, financial model in which this isn't actually about education, this is about the accumulation of resources, you have administrators who are in a position in which they don't know what Judaism is. They don't know what Zionism is. They probably actually don't know much about the decisions they're making. What they do know is if they alienate their financial base, they, you know, will collapse. And so in my case, there, you know, there was the petition, there were emails, there were robocalls that were coming in like 100 a minute to administrators, to Pennsylvania politicians, the mayor of Allentown, you know, demanding that I be fired, this kind of pressure on an institution that is, you know, dependent on this financial backing is a lot of pressure. Not that I'm defending the administrators, but, you know, it's existing within this financial crisis that has already existed. And then on the other hand, you have Zionists who are partnering with, you know, right-wing white supremacist groups that have been, you know, attacking DEI, you know, affirmative action, critical race theory, gender studies. You know, Jews who identify as Zionists are partnering with these very anti-Semitic sort of political and economic bodies that are using them to undermine equity initiatives on campus. And this is sort of part of a larger playbook that we've been seeing for decades. And so this sort of perfect collision made it so that I believe that my college felt as though they were in the position in which they would rather betray the integrity of higher education and what the institution is actually about in order to preserve the economic support that they felt they needed in this landscape in order to survive.
Yeah, that's really clear. It's really clear. Can you talk a little bit about the investigation as much as you can or want to into you? I mean, it's several hundred pages. It was very, very detailed. The fact that, you know, as you said, like, you know, they don't know the intricacies of this very stark difference between Judaism and Zionism. And yet they were picking apart every social media post that you had made within a certain time span, and getting testimonies from people. I mean, you know, they spent a lot of time and resources investigating your scholarship and your personality. Can you talk a little bit about that process and how that was for you?
Well, it wasn't fun. I'll say that. You know, it was a really weird process, in large part because what we're seeing with so many of these cases, it's a Title VI investigation, but at schools like Muhlenberg, I'm not sure if this is different at large universities, but at colleges like universities or institutions like Muhlenberg, small colleges, Title VI is held within the Title IX office. They operate together and are overseen by the same person. And, you know, we know from all kinds of stories about, sexual harassment and assault on campuses across the country, that Title IX is not always, you know, looking out for members of the community. They're more looking out for the interests of the institution. And what I learned through that process is that there's, you know, we talk about academic freedom as academics as though we understand what that means until all of a sudden we're faced with the reality of trying to explain and determine what we're actually protected by. And what I learned through that process is that, one, at a private college, you actually don't have academic freedom, not in any legal sense. And I think, you know, even at public universities, that's being eroded every day. But with these kinds of equal opportunity cases, they're lifted out of the policies and procedures that are laid out for faculty in like the faculty handbook. And they're put in a very secretive and very opaque Title IX process, which, you know, I think the most devastating thing about that process is that absolutely everything was marked personal and confidential. And so, you know, I'm on a small campus, and if I would like share with my department colleagues what was going on, because none of the faculty, staff, or students were told anything about what was happening to me. And if I would share anything, even the most vague details, somehow a day later I would get an email from the Title IX lawyer reminding me that this is a confidential procedure and I'm not allowed to speak about it with anyone. And so the college really created an environment in which, you know, in the best case scenario, my colleagues wouldn't know what was happening to me and, you know, wouldn't, you know, have the information that they needed in order to act. I did believe that I was able to talk about what was happening to me. And so I did talk with trusted colleagues. And what I found is that, you know, a lot of my colleagues wanted to believe in the administration and in the policies that were being laid out, because to not do so was to realize that they were working for an institution that did not have their best interest in mind. I think a lot of your listeners would never think that an institution would have their best interest in mind, but, you know, higher ed is a weird place. And so it really created this, this environment in which I was pretty isolated and didn't really feel as though I could move out of that isolation until I started connecting with other faculty across the country who were going through similar things. Judd Aliyah was a really incredible resource of drawing together, through some of their programming, scholars who were being targeted for Palestinian liberation and anti-Zionist speech. And so that was a really wonderful way to realize that this is just part of a playbook that we're seeing across the country. But the procedure itself was really isolating. It was really confusing. And it resulted in, sort of very liberal investigators and administrators who knew nothing about Palestine, who know nothing that's going on aside from what our, you know, political leaders and corporate media tell us, you know, sort of determining that I was an anti-Semitic monster because of the sort of things about me that actually make me a good anthropologist, right? Like, I question power. I, you know, question institutions. I question empire and settler colonialism. That's actually kind of inherent to what I think a good anthropologist should be doing. But I was told that doing anything controversial, making students feel unsafe because they're uncomfortable, you know, mixing up that language, was actually against the project of the liberal arts, which I always thought was about critical thinking. So all of this is to say it was very isolating, and it resulted in administrators basically, you know, telling me that because of my, you know, extramural speech on social media, I was unfit to be around young people, which is a pretty wild leap to make.
Yeah, no kidding. I want to go back to something that you mentioned, this whole concept of safety and what makes students of a certain political persuasion, i.e. pro-genocide, feel quote unquote safe, and how that's been weaponized on college campuses for a while now, you know, in terms of a way to shut movements down, shut professors down, make Palestine not only a toxic subject to teach about, you know, but potentially a danger to one's career. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you see the weaponization of you know, something that should be, I don't know, very, you know, protected. I mean, real safety, right? Real safety when it comes to students, when we think about whose safety is more valued than others, and what the term means and how it's been used as a cudgel in order to completely, you know, I mean, incapacitate its very meaning.
Yeah. You know, I was at Muhlenberg for 9 years. I was an adjunct for 3 years. So I was teaching for 12 years. And the entirety of my career as a professor sort of existed under the shadow of trigger warnings. And what I learned at two liberal arts colleges throughout my career is that the students who are most vulnerable and most unsafe in the classroom are not the ones who are calling for safety and trigger warnings and whatnot. It's students who have probably never felt uncomfortable before and who have never had to question their worldview, which, you know, I firmly believe is what you're college to do. You're not at college to learn what you already know. We're here to learn what we don't yet know. And we're all doing it together. And that has become such a threat because, you know, we have this language of safety and, you know, trigger warnings and whatnot. I used to tell my students way before this that, you know, everything I teach is a trigger warning. You know, I can't, you know, anticipate what is going to make my students feel uncomfortable, but I hope that everything we learn about makes them feel uncomfortable because the world is an uncomfortable place. And so, you know, I've been very, very dismayed to see the way in which this weaponization of unsafety is, first of all, coming from the far right, which I thought were like anti-snowflake, but, you know, now they'll use it. Yeah. They'll use it if it works. But, you know, we can think about how the university has never been a safe space for many people. And it's an incredibly hierarchical institution that's, you know, built on, you know, the ashes of indigenous genocide and the transatlantic slave trade. And, you know, many, many people are not, you know, truly safe at these institutions, right? We know that that's true. And so the question of whose safety is being taken seriously during the time in which I was being told that I was making certain students feel unsafe, I was also not just watching, you know, across the country as Arab, Muslim, Palestinian students were actually being physically targeted and experiencing actual violence. But I was also hearing it from the few students on my campus. I mean, it's a predominantly white institution, but I would, you know, hear from my students who were, you know, Palestinian, Arab, Muslim, students of color, that they really felt scared. They felt actually scared to be on campus and to talk about their own experiences. And, you know, when we talk about student safety on this sort of like larger national level, we're never talking about those students. We're talking about, you know, a sort of imagined Jewish Zionist racialized white student who supports genocide and wants to be able to do so freely without being made to feel bad about it. And, you know, after I was, you know, barred from campus in January, then I was watching student encampments around the country in which, you know, college presidents were calling the NYPD and other militarized police departments on their anti-Zionist students who were fighting for Palestinian liberation. That seems pretty unsafe to me, but this notion of feelings has really been weaponized to shut down any conversation in support of Palestinian liberation while also completely erasing the real material unsafety of, you know, anti-Zionist students in the United States, to say nothing of the hundreds of thousands of Palestinian students who've been killed by Israel's genocidal attacks on Gaza.
Yeah. What about, you mentioned that you were able to find little pockets of support in some of your colleagues on campus, but was there much of a campaign in support of you that was visible, that was helping you fight the administration throughout this process? What kind, or did people kind of, you know, kind of cower behind their desks, so to speak, because they feared for their own jobs?
Yeah, I mean, I want to be careful about the way I talk about my colleagues, because, you know, I think since the Intercept article broke, there's been a complete shift on campus. And I've always had, you know, the allies that I knew were, you know, on the same page with me. This was a small group, but I always knew that they were there. But I also think, you know, we don't like to talk about higher ed through the language of class struggle. But, you know, we have these institutions that are, first of all, like academics, there are no jobs anymore. And so, you know, for the jobs that are, you know, not even good jobs, you have hundreds of people who are trying to get these jobs. There's always this sense that, you know, we're in competition with each other and that we're disposable and replaceable. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, Muhlenberg really crystallized that in the sense that morale had been low with faculty and staff for years to a devastating degree. I think the administration had really, because of financial crisis that was, you know, even before COVID, I think the faculty in particular had really been made to feel, especially faculty in the humanities and social sciences, that not only were we all replaceable, but our departments were in, you know, danger of being downsized or, you know, collapsed into others. And so I think, you know, even before the fall of last year, it was really hard to get faculty to do anything other than do their job right in front of them, because that fear of drawing attention to oneself could actually, you know, risk one's job, and evidence of that. And so, you know, I think within that environment, it's really hard to have any kind of solidarity. I think people are just really scared. You know, my college doesn't pay particularly well. It's a pretty, you know, terrible economy. I think people were just overwhelmed and scared. I do think, you know, I don't believe in silver linings amidst a genocide, but I do think one of the things that has been at least, you know, a small source of comfort is that at least on campuses, I've been involved in Palestinian liberation work since 2003 when I was a master's student at Columbia. And I've never seen a like global movement in support of Palestinian liberation like I do now. And I think a lot of that is not enough, but a lot of that is happening on college and university campuses. And there are so many faculty who, you know, are protecting their students at encampments, who are, you know, putting their neck out on their line to push for divestment, who are challenging administrators, who are going to actions. And so, you know, while maybe it's hard to find at our individual institutions, I do think that there's a movement that I couldn't imagine, you know, 5 years ago that we're seeing now. Unfortunately, you know, our political leaders and our university and college leaders are Zionists, or they're cowards. And so we're seeing, you know, pretty devastating policies. But in terms of solidarity, I wish it was bigger, and also it's bigger than I ever could have imagined.
Mm. Yeah, indeed. And yeah, the tenacity of these students who are, you know, the administrations keep calling the cops and they keep coming back. It's not just in the US, but, you know, across North America, in Europe, it's pretty remarkable. And, you know, Yeah, I wanted to kind of ask about what your options are at this point. I mean, you know, are you pursuing any legal cases? Do you even want to get your job back at Muhlenberg after the way that they treated you and denigrated your scholarship and the reason why, you know, anthropology even exists in the first place? What are the next steps for you?
Yeah, I would like the choice. And I also think, you know, we're in appeals, and I'm really hoping that because it is a faculty panel, I'm really hoping that the faculty will see that, you know, regardless of what you think about me, I'm pretty insignificant when it really comes down to it. You don't have to like me, you don't have to support my work, but this sets a really terrifying precedent. And I'm really hoping that the faculty will see that and they will, you know, go against the provost's decision and, you know, then it would go to the president and who knows from there. But I'm hoping that at least on the level of faculty, I see a different move than the, you know, various processes that have happened so far. In terms of, you know, the future, I think that for me, it's about doing the work. And I think that the classroom, I think, you know, the university or the college is one place to do the work. I don't think it's the only place to do the work. And it's a really terrifying time to imagine both the present and future of academia and higher ed in the United States. I mean, I feel like every week I hear from a new faculty member, either someone I know or a stranger who reaches out or is connected to me through mutual friends, who's being sanctioned, suspended, threatened. And what does it mean to work in an environment like that? Like, what are our jobs as educators if we cannot teach about the world? And, you know, I'm pretty like narrow visioned right now, but I mean, there is nothing that I can imagine talking or thinking about that isn't beginning and ending with Palestine right now and isn't beginning and ending with a genocide that we're funding, that, you know, I've seen so many, you know, comrades in the 24th hour get on board with the Harris campaign and thinking about, you know, no matter what happens tomorrow, you know, funding a genocide continues to be in our future. And if we can't talk about that, if we can't push against that, if we can't organize against that, if we can't teach against that, then I don't know what the college or university is. I feel very scared and pessimistic about the future of higher ed in this country right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And as we were saying, I mean, you know, this could be seen as like the first shot across the bow in terms of like open season on tenured professors teaching, you know, God forbid, about the world, like you said, and understanding things in this global context and in this, you know, context of imperialism and capitalism and how Palestine, as you said, you know, we have to talk about it as the beginning and the end of all of these social, you know, machinations. Everything that we see going on, you know, here in the U.S. is directly related to what's happening in Palestine. And you know, what does this say about academia itself, about even the study, the field of anthropology, if it's being watered down, if it's being kind of eviscerated of its purpose in higher education? I mean, what kinds of conversations are you having, you know, with yourself and with your colleagues and friends about what this means for higher ed in general?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many. I mean, one of the big questions that, you know, is coming up, especially for faculty who teach at, you know, large universities in which, you know, they may have a class with 10 or 30 students. They might also have a class with 300 students. And I think, you know, we can't trust the classroom. I had the benefit for a long time of teaching at small liberal arts college, in which I felt like I was really building relationships with my students. Clearly, you know, there are limits to that project. But I also think that the idea of going into a classroom and knowing that your students could be recording you, they could be, you know, working with, you know, faculty, staff, administrators who are trying to get faculty on record who are talking about Palestine. I mean, I haven't said too much about this yet, but I was fired because of work that was being done by Hillel International. The student who filed the complaint was a leader in Hillel International and was supported by the two staff members who did that work. And we're really seeing, you know, for people who have been paying attention, we've seen this for a really long time, but Hillel International has really presented itself as the space for Jewish life on campus. And perhaps that was true 50 years ago, but now Hillel is very explicitly a Zionist organization. Their website says that Israel is the center of their work. They are, you know, often the space in which students are getting radicalized through like Hasbara fellowships or Birthright. A lot of the students that I was aware of at Muhlenberg, you know, moved to Israel after they graduated or they joined the Israeli military or they had their sights on that because of programming that Hillel International was doing. And this sort of provides support for students to be, you know, targeting their professors, recording their professors, going after their professors to the point in which, you know, it is very scary for folks to go into the classroom and teach about this material because we don't know who's in our classrooms. We don't know who's watching and listening. And I think that the power of institutions like Hillel, the ways in which donor money is operating on campuses creates an environment in which I on the one hand believe that the way to fight this is for everyone to be teaching about Palestine, to have that be like a critical mass. But I also understand that, you know, a lot of my colleagues, a lot of my friends, a lot of academics who are struggling to make, you know, this job work for them, they don't have the support that they need in order to lose their jobs. You know, it might jeopardize their citizenship. They might be supporting a family. They might, you know, be in a situation in which like this job is making or breaking their existence. And so I can't judge people who are scared because it really makes sense. But I think, you know, from my perspective, we all need to be talking about Palestine. We all need to be teaching about Palestine because, you know, in an ideal world, they can't fire us all. And this kind of solidarity work, I think, is really necessary. And I can't really imagine that happening in a country like the United States.
Yeah. Maybe one day.
Maybe.
I want to ask you about advice that you have for other professors, tenured or adjunct or, you know, contract, but also students who are watching what's happened to you and Steve Saleta and so many professors and academics and scholars over the years, students who, you know, have been suspended or put on academic probation for attending a protest. What's your advice as someone who has been through that process and has been fired over your, you know, political, moral, ethical stance?
Yeah, so this may seem like a detour, but I was really lucky. I had some incredible teachers when I was in high school that were sort of non-traditional, even at a public high school like my own. And one of them was this really incredible, I mean, you know, probably complicated, but really incredible anarchist, vegan, Washington Post reporter named Coleman McCarthy, who taught this class called Peace Studies. And he really taught me so much. I mean, when I was 16 years old, he was taking me to Lockheed Martin on the weekends to protest. He was teaching me about these connections. He was really incredible. He also didn't always stop at red lights, which was an interesting lesson for a teenager like me. But he told me, you know, when you're doing this work, you have to be prepared for the loss that it will entail. Like, we never get rewarded for this work. At least not by those with power. We do by our communities. We do through our, you know, collective connections. But we, you know, there will always be loss. associated with this work. We do not get rewarded for challenging power. And I think, you know, I am seeing students across the country who really understand this and really feel like the loss is worth it, because what on earth are they inheriting? What, I mean, the world is such a disaster right now, and these young people are inheriting it, and they are imagining an otherwise. They are imagining a better future, and the only way that they are going to get it is by putting themselves on the line. It's really been inspiring, and I think a lot of my colleagues get that too, that there is loss associated with this work. But I think it's really important for us to think about what we have and what we can afford to lose, and how we can show up with those understandings really clearly articulated to ourselves. Because I think there's so many different ways to be in the movement. We don't all have to be doing the same kind of thing. You know, I was just at University of Michigan talking to some incredible faculty and students and staff last week. And, you know, one of the things that someone told me that I hadn't really thought about before, but you know, they were saying, you know, we're hearing about what happened to you. We're thinking about all of the statutes that have been changed. Like, one thing that faculty can be doing right now is really getting clarity on the shifting procedures that are being used to target students, target faculty and staff as well, to put pressure on institutions to be more transparent. And there's ways to do that work without taking the kinds of risks that, you know, other people are doing that are more visible, that are more politicized. I think there's so many different ways to be supporting this project. And I think it's about having a real clarity over what you have, what you can lose, and how to sort of use that information to get keyed into being part of what is a growing movement invested in all kinds of liberation. I mean, I think Palestine shines a mirror on empire. And what we are seeing is the underbelly of so many aspects of, you know, liberal democracy that people have been turning their heads away from for a really, really long time. And we can't do that anymore. And so I think there's just so many different ways to, you know, use the skills and the tools and the sort of positions that we have to be involved and do the work. But it also involves, you know, it always involves giving up something, whether it be time or energy or job.
Yeah, there are many sacrifices, and it is all important as you said, to find your place in the movement and keep going. And
And I mean, I will say, like, you know, I didn't have, you know, the best year, but I'm in the United States. I'm, you know, living what is a pretty safe and comfortable life. I lost my job, but I actually haven't really lost that much. And I think we just have to keep our eye on Gaza. We have to keep our eye on the occupied West Bank. We have to keep our eye on Lebanon and remember that we owe Palestinians, we owe folks in Lebanon, we owe folks who are actually being annihilated, we owe them our attention, we owe them our time, we owe them our work. I mean, this is, I think, what it means to be a person who is paying attention, to realize that, you know, we have sacrifices to make because, you know, at least here in the United States, everything that I have is the result of extraction and theft. And, you know, I might not be directly involved in that, but we're living very comfortable lives in the US in comparison to people who are living through genocide. So I keep that in mind when I think about the things that I've lost.
It's incredibly important. Absolutely. Maura, where can people find your work?
I spend far too much time on Twitter and Instagram. So I'm there. I have a website. It's maurafinkelstein.com. I post all of my essays. I every day I'm like, I'm going to spend less time on social media. And every day, there
just
we are.
Right back in. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And we'll link to, all of your various platforms in the blog post that accompanies this interview. Maura Finkelstein, I am so grateful for you and for being a strong, you know, teacher for so many inside and outside the classroom. I'm just, yeah, I just, I wish you the best, and please keep us posted on what happens next.
Thank you. It was an honor to be here. I'm really grateful.
Thank you. Thank you.